Hey, honeys, just a little reminder that you are enough. Go out and be free.
A lot of people approach their bodies as if it's a problem to be solved. And I really want people to think about where they got that message from. Is their body the problem to be solved? Or did we arrive here because of everything that's happened to us and our ancestors?
Child peace, child peace. If you want it, you got it, go get it. Child peace, child peace. The world is waiting for you.
Child please. Child please.
Hey, honey.
I think I would like to sing the theme song for next season. What do you think about that, Ivy?
You should do it. We could do a remix. I'll rap on the background. It'd be like,
you know what? I don't know if you've ever sung it live, like for real. Can you just give us a little?
No.
A little taste.
We're not doing that today.
For those of you who don't know, Ivy sings our theme song.
And in a closet.
She recorded in her closet because she is scrappy like that. And she used to be, well, you were in like a full band.
Yeah, we used to travel around and we made a couple of albums. And every once in a while, this is a really weird situation. Every once in a while, you'll be in a big crowd and you'll be walking around and I will see someone wearing one of our t-shirts.
Oh, what was the band called?
It was called Revelation. When I was,
we had a vintage Revelation shirt.
I have one that's framed one of the boxes in my house. But every once in a while, you'll see someone and you'll, I don't even care. I run up on folks. I'd be like, where did you get that shirt from?
Then you break out into song.
Yeah, like some crazy guy was like, I don't know, it was this cool band, like, you know, like 10 years ago, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, that's me!
I love that. I love that. Celebrity status.
Oh my God.
So what's been going on, superstar?
So, you know, it's interesting, given our topic today, it's interesting. I have been having one of those moments where I was like, I need to refocus myself because I have a lot of pep talks with myself. And when I talk to myself, I don't necessarily talk to myself as gently as I should.
What's the voice? Is that what the voice sound like? What's the voice sound like?
This is what you need to do. No. Get it together, girl. No. But I did say to myself that I am tired. If there's one thing that I'm really tired of in my life, it is going into my closet because I have an event I want to go to or someplace I want to be and having it become an emergency because all the beautiful clothes that I have in my closet do not fit me right now. And I can't even blame COVID anymore. It ain't COVID's fault. COVID is like looking at me like, I don't even understand how you still calling my name like that. But, you know, I have really decided this year that I wanted to take more control over my health again because I had done all this athletic stuff and built this body and I was hanging out on boats in Thailand, showing my abs off with no troubles, didn't have to suck.
Boats in Thailand? Happy.
Yes. But now I am under many layers of caftans.
And I love moo-moos. A caftan, though. I love a caftan, honey. I have many of them.
I'm not mad about it.
I have many.
But now I'm in a moo-moo and mad. So, you know, I started with a trainer again, and I started sort of getting my life back together and just getting control over my body image and how I think about, you know, what I want to look like naked. And I think for me, I have always been a person who was I was always sort of self-conscious. I've always, when I was younger, even thought I was fat. I look back on my pictures. You know, when you look back on your pictures, you say to yourself, I was not fat. My whole mindset was...
Where do you think that came from then, young?
I know exactly where it came from, but don't get me started talking about my family life again. No, it came from when I was a young girl growing up in a house with a sister who was 5'10" and 130 pounds. And I was 5'8" and 180 pounds. It just, I was always chubby. like, or just bigger than her. And in my mind, I was fat. And that was the thing that she could use anytime we had a fight, anytime anything was happening. The thing that was called out was, well, you fat anyway, or... Exactly. And then you go back and you look through your high school years, you look through your yearbooks, you look through your college stuff, you look through your photos, and you're like, I wasn't fat. You know, I used to run cross country track. I had big thighs. I was a big girl, always been a big girl. I'm 5'10" now. And well, was I about to say my weight online?
Well, you're tall. Yes,
I am tall, but like I've always been a bigger girl. But like it took me getting into adulthood to stop fighting, one, my body's natural like frame, and saying to myself, it's not about being whatever this ideal is that you have in your head. It's about being the ideal for your body. But even so, when I go to my trainer and he says, well, I want to understand what kind of body you're trying to build. And he hands me this sheet that has all these pictures of different women on the sheet. And 80% of the women were white. And it was like, well, what's the body I'm trying to build? And I was like, well, really, none of these here. none of these seem to make any sense for me. So I sent him, and I'm look, it's aspirations. You know what I'm saying? I
sent him a picture of
Serena Williams.
Serena Williams.
I sent him a picture of Serena, and I said, the way that my frame is set up, well, I get muscular, I get thick and I get muscular, and I'm okay. I'm totally okay with that.
But we also know what kind of training.
Well, of course, but I'm not trying to, I'm not trying to emulate her, but I'm just saying what I was saying to him was, I don't want to be a skinny white woman, you know, with this kind of waist and like, I want to be a big, healthy, athletic looking black woman. And I want my goals to be reflected in pictures of big, healthy, athletic looking black women.
Wow, Serena. Ooh, what?
Girl, aspirations.
What a frame.
You got to have a goal. What a frame. You can't just be out here, you know.
But I think that's so interesting because, you know, I think a lot of what we've talked about this season is, you know, how things in the past, how childhood has really informed how we see ourselves. In all ways, in all ways.
Absolutely.
So like this is feels still so connected to all the conversations that we've been having for sure.
Absolutely. We are still, as we always say, you know, learning and trying to find our way through this.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, yes. Well, we're not the only ones. We have a bunch of honeys and honeys in training who have been really feeling this season in particular. And we just want to shout out a few of them who've been, you know, listeners and giving us just all kinds of encouragement online. So shout out to Rashida Crockett, an amazing actress, a honey in training, who declares, and I love this, child please is my shit. Mine too. Mine too.
We love you, Rashida.
Shout out to Pamela Hill for her lovely email. Shout out to Zora, Tony Maya on Twitter, and City Not Parish Girl on Twitter for their love. We really appreciate it. So please keep it coming. Tweet us, DM us. Hit us up on Instagram at It's Child Please. We really appreciate all of y'all.
We love that. Thank you, ladies.
So what are we talking about today? You kicked us off so nicely.
Well, today we're going to talk a little bit about body image. We're going to talk a little bit about how Black women in particular think about body image and how that connects to our health goals. And today, as part of that conversation, we have an amazing guest with us. Jessica Wilson is a clinical dietitian, author, and activist whose work centers the voices and experience of those most marginalized in the eating disorder field. She is the co-founder of the hashtag Amplify Melanated Voices movement to elevate content creators, including dietitians, therapists, and body liberation advocates. By the way, sign me up to be a body liberation advocate, who are Black, Indigenous, and other peoples of color. Her new book, It's Always Been Ours, Rewriting the Story of Black Women's Bodies, explores the ways in which Black women and femmes are left out of conversations about diet culture, health, and wellness. It unpacks the ways in which whiteness and capitalism have shaped how we view and treat our bodies and how the contemporary solutions to this continue to center white, thin women and erase others. Welcome to Child Please, Jessica.
Welcome, honey. We need to get into this. Yes, welcome.
We have to get into it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming.
Absolutely. I'm already excited.
First off, can we just talk about How did you come to this work?
There was a long pause there. I'm like, where do I start? But since you all have been talking about childhood, I'll just give you the TLDR, quick summary. When I was very young, my body was too big for the, you know, growth charts at the doctor's office. I was growing fine. I was, you know, all of, you know, fine on those curves, but I was at the top. And for a Black girl in, you know, white society, that was too big. So that was the message I was given. And I was sent to a dietitian myself at age 6, where I was told to basically diet. And why do you tell 6 year olds? At 6 years old.
Wow.
I just found the chart note in the paper chart note. Sue was apparently the dietitian's name. I don't remember the advice because I was 6, but I was reading it. Right. So at that point, I recognized that, you know, Black bodies are a problem. Mm. And then I was like more focused on weight and body stuff than I should have been at 6, at 8, at 10, 12, and through high school. And because I was, you know, always paying attention to like food and stuff, when somebody said I could become a dietitian and just talk about food, I said, that's great. Let me do that. And it wasn't until I was actually in my schooling was I learning about Black people. That's in, you know, air quotes, because I'm learning about what Black people eat and what, you know, what they need to do differently and all these things. And I was like, uh-oh, this is not the field for me. I'm still a dietitian, but that was when it started to unravel.
Wait, are you saying that as part of the dietitian curriculum, there is a whole sort of section about here's what Black people eat and why they should stop it?
Basically, yes. And Asian Americans, so white rice, need to just knock it out. Tortillas with meals for Latinx cultures. Like, why are there tortillas and rice and beans? The same for Indian meals, like naan and all these extra carbs.
They didn't come after the naan, because you know how I feel about the naan. They didn't come after the naan, did they?
Seriously. So
there's a policing of the food that people of color are eating?
Policing, but also pathologizing, right? So it's not just like they need to not do this, like it's bad. Like these are all the reasons it's, quote, unhealthy. The automatic assumption that everything, you know, all Mexican food is cooked with lard and all Southern food is cooked with pork products. And, you know, why do you need extra this or that? Yeah, those were the moments.
You're blowing my mind.
Right, I know. We're both like,
mouths open. Well, I mean, we recognize that there have been trends for a long time where we know that, you know, most of what we know about psychiatry and psychology was done on white men in the 50s and 60s. Most of what we know about women's health was done with, you know, kind of racist studies that in many cases were done on people who were enslaved. So it is insane to me that still today, at our big age as a country, we are still in the medical profession having these kinds of conversations that are vilifying foods that are cultural in nature.
Absolutely. I was last year, long ago, I think it's 2022. Yeah, I was at a public health conference and it was basically all about how people needed to be eating quinoa, kale, nuts, olive oil, fruits and vegetables, and that's it. And somebody asked, you know, oh, you know, in my culture, we eat white rice, like, and nobody's going to give that up. So like, how can we adjust these? And they were like, actually, you need to just not eat white rice. That's the solution. That's the answer. I was like,
So the Chinese who have some amongst the longest longevity, they're just wrong.
They're actually unhealthy, even if they might be unhealthy, you know, because actually that is part of what it is the social construction of health. And in, you know, the US, that social construction of health does not include white rice.
Can you talk about that? Can you talk about the social construction of health and how you identify it and use it in your work? And then I want to talk about where you turned, who you turned to, what you turned to when you were in school, like learning and realizing that that way was not for you.
Sure. So social construction, I'm just remembering, and then like in school. So you already talked about how a lot of medicine, how Black women particularly have been the research, but were never actually included like in research. Mm-hmm. Nothing is the best practice in my mind if we don't include Black women and Black folks in like research when we're coming up with interventions that are supposed to work. But because of our, you know, eugenic and really racist medical history, health has been constructed as thin, as white. Initially, it was very Anglo-Saxon. So, you know, health was invented really with the mindset of positioning Africans at the time, but Black people as unhealthy, white folks as healthy, and like furthering that race. So like how that has evolved.
I knew it by the BMI charts because I was like, I am morbidly obese on the BMI charts. Come on.
Right.
Come on. Get real.
Yeah. And they're just made up numbers. Like it's a ratio of your weight to height. It's supposed to mean something. It doesn't. We made up what these cutoffs are. There's no science about them. So yeah, we've socially constructed health to look and be a certain BMI and all of these things that aren't real.
So you're in school and you're like, this is bullshit. Where do you turn? What? How do you, because you're still, like you said, you're still a dietitian. How do you then find your way and continue to do work?
It took a long, long time. So I will always say, like, I didn't meet like a philosophically aligned dietitian until 2020. And I didn't meet one in person until 2023, like just recently, which is ridiculous. So that was 10, 20 years of all of this journey. But in my grad school program, there was like this, you know, misfit group. There was one Latina woman, one Asian girl, one chubby girl, and the one Black student. So it was like the group of people who were being talked about. Mm-hmm. So there's like the four of us there. And then all through high school, I started learning more about physiology because I was very aware then that calories in did not actually equal calories out, that folks were just naturally larger. And like, so all of like, what am I needing to unlearn now that I was taught then? And so that is actually when I started being more into the health at every size communities and really learning about weight science and how there really isn't a direct tie between health and weight. So unfortunately, you know, that was a lot of baby boomer white women who were doing that work. I appreciate weight science and the, you know, start of the health at every size movement, but quickly realized that it just wasn't for me. So it hasn't really been until like the last few years that I've really, you know, found clinicians who align with what I'm seeing as well.
So you mentioned health at every size. Can you talk a little bit about what that means? And, you know, what do you think about that as a framework?
I came to health at every size in 2012-ish. And at the time, it was a very radical paradigm that was questioning, again, the idea that weight was a direct outcome of your health. So if you were overweight, you were inherently unhealthy. And at the time, the people who were doing a lot of that organizing, again, were, you know, white baby boomers and were really, really resistant to my discussion of trauma, of health disparities and all of that. It was a very singular issue of helping those white women be treated like thin people at the doctor's office. In the last decade, they have made strides to be more intersectional. Right now, Health at Every Size has a predominantly folks of color on their board. They're working on the idea that health is a, you know, not a goal. It's not morally superior to other states of being. That was something else that kept coming up for me. I would talk to larger folks who were folks of color, trans folks, and who were saying, it doesn't matter what size I am when I go to the doctor's office, I'm still Black, I'm still trans. So like really having this focus be just on, you know, eating intuitively and exercising is the way to like counter everything in the medical establishment. Like that's nice for y'all, but like these are the things that we're experiencing. So the Health at Every Size movement is making strides to have those conversations and make more of a liberationist lens. They've got a ways to go, but I don't identify as a health at every size provider yet.
So, Jessica, we'd love to get your perspective too on this idea of obesity as a disease. So, with the advent of these new weight loss drugs from the pharmaceutical companies like Wegovy and Mounjaro, what are your thoughts on this sort of narrative surrounding obesity? Because, you know, we don't be trusting the pharmaceutical companies. You know, they like to create diseases so they could cure them with expensive drugs. But we'd love to hear your perspective on this one.
That's the summary statement. That body size in and of itself, BMI, was never a diagnostic tool until people realized that they could start getting, you know, reimbursement for, quote, treating it. And as soon as we were able to label obesity as a, quote, disease, then you can sell things to treat it. what we're doing is being fat phobic. So there are so many people, you know, it's easy for us to say that, you know, super muscular people have a BMI over 30 and are technically obese, but it's not really about that. It's about fat phobia, right? Mm-hmm. If people were able to be diagnosed as a disease with a BMI over 40, it would be every professional athlete ever. It just would. But what we're doing is saying fatness is a bad thing. And how do we try and make that a disease when it's really not?
Can you actually talk about how we internalize fat phobia ourselves?
Yeah. So a bit more about Black folks is that we just naturally have higher bone density and muscle mass than our paler peers. And that is not accounted for. Like, that is in the science. People know that and have known that for decades, but we don't have different BMI cutoffs. So just inherently, Black folks are going to weigh more. BMIs are going to be higher, just baseline. And because our BMI is higher, like, we're going to be told, as I was from a very young age, that we need to lose weight. And it's hard when you're getting those messages young, when our parents are telling that, when society is telling us that, to not think that our bodies, again, are too big, which, again, we're being told in different ways, but how we want our bodies to conform to what societal expectations are. Like, we're just not immune to that. And maybe we're not going to be thin because we're Black folks. We're not going to be like white girl thin, but like, how else can we, you know, conform our bodies in a ways, you know, that can either make it thinner or look different, because we just have these narratives that what Shayna's grandmother would call healthy bodies, you know, it's not okay. They need to basically look like thin white girl bodies.
Break out of the narrative. As this nice woman on the internet said, you don't owe anybody flat tummy.
Oh, I love how you are quoting. She got all the internet quotes today.
You don't owe anybody flat tummy.
How do you classify, like, your perspective? How do you define it?
It's a great question.
As an escapee from the mainstream. Like, what
we
is
always have to
philosophy?
Come up with our way of.
That's, yeah, but I think that's the problem, right? Yeah. Like, because the next way is the next right way, and then we have the next right way, but mm-hmm. like the last right way was the wrong way, and so now we have the next one, but it might be wrong at some point too. And I think that's part of the problem. We went from, you know, dieting being popular to then, you know, being all about anti-diet culture. And like, diet culture was a set of principles and it included like thin ideals. And it was just solving problems that were never solving like the structural issues that really, you know, are at the roots of, mm-hmm. you know, how our bodies are policed and how we're treated. And somebody, a friend of mine, calls my philosophy, eat food and feel how it feels. That's what we're talking about here. That's, you know, like eat that. Food.
No, but I kind of feel that. I mean, I have been on every, I'm not even going to say diet, but I've eaten in so many lifestyles over, if I think about the last 10 to 15 years, you know, you start off as a young person and we all started off with the food pyramid, which we all know is a lie because the food pyramid was so influenced by food producers that it said grains were the things you should eat most of, when now everyone is saying that's completely upside down. Then it was the food plate, where they were like, oh, just, you know, fill most of your plate with some vegetables and maybe put some chicken on there. No. And then, you know, between all of the new sort of eating styles, the low fat, low carb, Atkins diet, South Beach diet, Mediterranean diet, then the all the eat like a caveman, eat closest to nature, be a paleo person, you know, then whole foods, nothing with, you know, any sort of artificial ingredients. Like, it just could make you crazy to even just understand what you're supposed to eat.
Well, first of all, I appreciate this walkthrough that you just gave us, honey.
Girl,
just gave
keto, us like the whole I was keto for 2 years when I was only eating fats.
The whole history of diet culture in 2 minutes.
I have done every possible eating style. And I don't like to say diet because I think most people think about diets as being very short term. But I'm talking about where I did 3 years of this and was like, is this working for me? Or how is my insulin levels? How am I like? And I've done every single one. All of them work if you do them. But do all of them make you healthier? They make you lose weight, but do they make you healthier? It's really hard to say. But now, like, I totally agree with this idea that you should just eat. Like, to me, I eat I call it closer to nature, meaning I try to eat less things that are in packages. And I try to cook more for myself and do what I like to eat, but like try to do it in a way that I have hands on the food and there's not as much things coming out of containers with ingredients on the outside of it. And that's all I can do. And if that's all I can do and it's delicious for me, then it's fine.
There we go. We have it.
I think one that you missed was intermittent fasting in that recall there.
Girl, did I not intermittent fast? Did I not 6, 12, 5? Did I not?
Well, how is this impacting Black women you've seen in your work in very specific ways?
So the desperation is something that is super prevalent. But with all of these like right and wrong ways, I always say that I got into the eating disorder field accidentally. I went to work in college health, right? I want to work with these young folks who are like learning how to adult themselves, are going to go grocery shopping, et cetera. Turns out a lot of people in college don't eat food. They have eating disorders and I didn't know what I was doing. Had this like very steep learning curve.
So you had a mix of students who all were having sort of problems figuring out how to manage food and how to make sure that they were eating it. Like what kinds of eating disorders were you seeing in the college communities?
So, and even until 2022, I was working in college health. So I was in and then out and back in. And the ways that eating disorders presented across cultures was so different. So often for young white women, the desire was to be thinner. Like it was that type of simple. And then for Black and brown women, oftentimes the ideal goal was to be safer, you know, emotionally safer or physically safer. And then we had folks who were not eating because of perhaps some body related trauma that was making them, you know, not take care of their own body. I think specifically about one of the clients that I mentioned in my book who was biracial and growing up in a predominantly white space, like it was always too curvy for the people there. But after, you know, going to college, lost a bunch of weight and all of a sudden found herself desirable to white folks. And so she was, you know, using that as like a social strategy. I think about Black women all the time who, you know, we're told that we're too much regardless of what size we are. I think especially in the workplace, sometimes on social media and in other mixed environments where we're just like inherently too much, we take up too much space. And so I see, you know, in college academic programs that are predominantly white, Black women can, you know, literally shrink themselves and take up less space and develop an eating disorder from seeing how better, like how much better they're treated by their predominantly white classmates or professors, because, you know, there's a hyper visible and invisible dichotomy that often happens. People become more comfortable with their existence when they take up actually less space. So that's how it's different for me and the clients that I see.
I think there's also some connection back to, I can still tell you right now today, like some of my family members, the first thing they'll do when they haven't seen you in a long time is before they even say hello to you is comment on your weight. And so it just feels more acceptable to be thinner. And so that level of trying to control it in a, like I imagined it for my family's gaze and it's more important to me. I would never have imagined like thinking about that in a way in a workplace of trying to build that same sort of recognition from getting thinner in the workplace. Wow.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about, you know, you definitely in your work come from a trauma-informed approach to these conversations as opposed to a privileged diet culture one. Like how do you make the connection to the two? How do you sort of approach that in your work?
I think something that is lost is the listening and just to listen. Because all of those folks, you know, had far different stories than just showing up and me making assumptions like you just want to be thinner, you know, so why don't you eat? And so listening to them and then being able to validate that their body narratives have been written by white supremacy. I understand what you're going through. How can we make choices? And really, maybe now it's not the time for you to engage in recovery. So from my perspective, or the way I come out things, is more just like trying to understand what people are saying rather than coming in with assumptions, as many clinicians do. Yeah, they don't ask about trauma. They don't ask about, you know, immigration status, acculturative stress. They don't, you know, ask about any of that, your adverse childhood events. So,
So it sounds like in your role as a dietitian, you're sort of touching on psychological stresses. You're touching on like almost like being a social worker in some ways, and sort of asking about their backgrounds and how
environmental
that sort of,
stresses.
Yeah, it's like so many different places that you need to touch on. Is that something that you're seeing more in the dietitian community, that people are starting to think more about the stressors around the whole person? It's not just about the food and the food diary and the managing of that particular, you know, this meal or the next meal.
Right. Yes. And so I've heard that from older dietitians, white dietitians. It'll be very interesting. They'll say, yes, I understand what you're saying about trauma-informed care, about health disparities. So how do we make a trauma-informed way to make people lose weight? It is like, how do we, you know, ask the right questions to do the same thing? That just happened. It was like, Jessica, can you make a questionnaire for us? That's not what this work is.
And where do you feel like, because, you know, you also talk about body positivity and how it fails to serve marginalized communities, including queer and trans people. Where do you feel like the body positivity movement fits within all of this?
The way I think about body positivity is the ability to think yourself into, you know, having a better body, or to think yourself to positivity. And so often with body image concerns, like, these are not things that we're just coming up or making up in our mind. These are the things that are happening to us when we leave and walk outside. Like, I can feel great and very positive about my own body, you know, but then I walk outside. So the, you know, interventions and creating like this cognitive dissonance, so that we know that we're able to question like our internal thoughts about our body. And I'm like, it's not internal. Like, I went to work today and I was treated this way. So body positivity is just really easy when you're already privileged. For the rest of us, not so much. Yeah, we can't kale and quinoa ourselves out of systemic racism, is what I'll say.
So what do you feel like is the goal then? What do you feel like is like what you hope to achieve with your work, or what you hope your clients achieve in working with you?
I think it's what I hope to do is ask people to critique and question what they think to be true, both about their bodies, about food. A lot of people approach their bodies as if it's a problem to be solved. And I really want people to think about where they got that message from. Is their body the problem to be solved? Or did we arrive here because of everything that's happened to us and our ancestors? And so for people, as well as my clients, like, that is something that I hope comes from our work and my work. And, you know, there are people who are really good, I think, at like envisioning new worlds, folks like Sonia Renee Taylor, who are really great at like world building. I think that I'm, you know, just hoping to poke the cracks and show folks that we need a new world.
I love that, because that's the thing, right? Like, do I feel this way about my body? Is that me really feeling this way about my body? Yeah. Or is that like all the things that tell me I should feel this way about my body?
That's deep.
Well, let's just for a second turn the tables a little bit and talk about white people. So one of the things that you explore in your work is sort of that the idea of the whitewashed formal, you know, dietitian, nutrition education. But you also talk a little bit about, like we were saying earlier, about how the vilification of ethnic foods has become sort of predominant. And I think that's really interesting, because I particularly live in Harlem in New York. And so, you know, I have been elbowed to the side at Charles's Pan Fried Chicken by white folks trying to get to the green beans and the hog maws and the fried chicken and the ribs and stuff. And so it's interesting to see how so many more white people in gentrifying areas are looking to actually eat these sort of things, fried green tomatoes, et cetera. So I would just love your perspective on how that sort of influence is changing. Is it changing at all what we think about as diet culture? And is that a benefit for people that white folks are eating fried green tomatoes now, or is it?
I think that's the question, right? And unfortunately, no, right? It's still Southern food. It's not like new hipster food. We're not calling fried green tomatoes hipster food. It's okay for, you know, white people to enjoy, you know, a foodie's paradise of Southern food. But then, you know, they dip in, they dip out. They're still white and going to be fine. But folks who might eat that, you know, on a more regular basis, that's when it's a problem. Even though nobody in the Bay Area cooks, they eat out every night. Like, that's just, you know, what they're, what's happening. And I think about soda taxes in Black and brown neighborhoods, but with the rise of mocktails, everybody's just drinking fancy sodas, but we're still talking fancy about sugar. Those people. Yeah, those people who are drinking Sprite. And I'm like, it's just a fancy Sprite. Like, come on. Why are we creating this dichotomy of like one's good and one's bad? Really, because what, you know, folks are Black, brown, and or poor, and that's what you don't value. And then there's you who's just not drinking alcohol, and that's better.
Mm-hmm. So can you talk about your book and how you came to write the book and what you feel like is sort of the biggest core message you're trying to get across?
The book I always share, I did not want to write. I declined it many times after, honestly.
Well, we're glad you did. We are so glad
Thank you
wrote this book.
In the end, I am glad as well. Yes, I was asked to write it. And I said no, because that sounds hard. And let me tell you, I was right. But I work with people one-on-one, and there's only so much I can do. So talking it over with friends, I was like, if I can reach, you know, 500 people rather than one, okay, I guess it was, you know, it'd be worth it. And then I think that part ties into, you know, there might not be like an answer food-wise, but there is healing in community. So, you know, if these ideas are amongst, you know, more people, maybe there's not like a heal for, quote, being healthy, but like, how can we find and lean on community, and how do we find resilience in community?
I love this idea of community, because to me, one of the reasons why I've always loved to cook for other people is it feels nurturing, you know, and you don't want to be so wrapped up in the question of, am I serving the exact right? Am I proportionally creating this? Like, am I doing, like, you just want to nurture people. And so the idea that food can be brought back into the idea of community is, I think, really important. Because it's also what brings everybody to something. You know, you can't have an event without no good food there.
Right. I mean, Soul Food Sundays, you know, at my Big Mama's house, you know, that was every Sunday.
I love this idea, you know, at my old place, I think I want to rejuvenate it at some point when I get in my new place. But my old place, I used to have once a month, we would have a Sunday dinner and invite as many people, friends and close acquaintances as you can, and just feed people and sit around and laugh.
Yeah. Right.
That's
the joy.
After everybody gets full. Everybody opens the top button on their pants and then they sit around and laugh and tell stories.
And it's so interesting because, again, I feel like there's so many connections to what we talk about on the podcast, because you mentioned resilience and overworking, and we talk about that a lot. We talk about how can we get away from that? How can we unleash ourselves? But the, you know, your book title talks about reclaiming the narrative. How do you think that we can go about reclaiming that narrative and be rewritten as vulnerable versus this assigned resilience?
Right. So that comes from my analysis of that comes from like Black women's bodies, you know, always been like written and valued for our productivity, for our labor, really the mammification that started earlier. And so, you know, we're written as angry, we're written as hypersexual, we're written as, you know, resilient. And we don't need that. We need to rewrite ourselves and reclaim our joy as the center of our being, and not like our ability to labor for the greater good, you know. I always think of Stacey Abrams and how she was, you know, the one that was going to be responsible from saving us in 2020. And I'm like, what? I mean, I get it, but also like, why?
But also, it's absurd.
Yes. Yeah. Rewriting our stories to be vulnerable in a way that is not just vulnerable to society and the trauma of, you know, living under white supremacy, but vulnerable getting to just be in community and celebrate joy.
Yes, that's what I just want to be.
Yeah, boring.
It's hard. I would love just being
boring.
Yes, I love just being. Mm-hmm. That's it.
But you mentioned 2020, Jessica, and I want to connect the dots here because in 2020, you and health therapist Alicia McCullough challenged people to mute the white voices on social media during the aftermath of George Floyd's murder in favor of amplifying melanated voices instead. And that's where the hashtag amplify melanated voices came from, and that went viral. What was it like to be sort of center stage in creating that movement in that particular, in such a pivotal time?
Yeah, it really came from like just a place of rage, honestly. Like it was this like slapped together moment and it was actually prior to George Floyd's murder that we had just chosen June 1 and like things continued to happen and happen and happen. That was really, you know, in COVID, people were talking about health disparities in Black and brown people. And the white folks were speaking, quote, speaking out on it and getting praised for bringing attention to these issues that we've been talking about forever.
We've been saying forever.
Right. Like, this is not new. You just haven't been listening.
Right.
And so, yeah, we were just over it. And then, you know, things in 2020 continued to happen. And I thought, you know, I took a screenshot of my Instagram because I was really convinced I was going to lose followers. So I took a screenshot. I had 1,000 followers. We're like, this is going to go terribly. I'm going to use this as receipts. You all are not ready. The opposite happened. The opposite happened. I think people were looking for things to do. And that was one of them. And it was wild, to be honest. My family was not prepared for me to be on social media so much.
So how do you take care of yourself in this work, right? Like you are listening to a lot of intense stories, I'm sure, and traumas, and you yourself have shared, you know, your experience with diet culture. How do you take care of yourself in all of that?
The group chat is always there for me.
You gotta have the group chat behind you.
Group chat. It gets screenshots. It gets, you know, receipts of things. The group chat is definitely one of them. And then again with that joy. So, you know, out in California, you know, we're a bit woo out here. So I'm like, let me dip into some woo. I got my first psychic reading and she was like, you need to be outside. And I was like, I do need to be outside. So just finding these bits of, you know, joy in my day. Dogs always help. Having the community there and then finding the ways to have just bits of joy.
And do you feel like, I hope this isn't too personal, but do you feel like you yourself have found a healthy relationship with food and society and how that all collides?
Food, yes. My body, yes. Society, no.
Society can go to hell.
I don't even know why I asked that, girl. My bad.
Yeah. But the ways that society views me, the context has been helpful, like to watch my body expand and do other things, you know, during pandemic as many did. I did get to give myself my own lessons. In the book, I talk about how my mentee, Lexi, who's featured in the chapter on eating disorders, came to stay with us after experiencing a couple personal losses. And so with her history of an eating disorder, like I really needed to also make peace like ASAP. I was not going to be the person speaking poorly of myself or my eating habits. So I was just like, we're just going to have to fully embrace this because as we know, like we can tell when other people are not okay with their bodies. And I just did not want that to be part of what was going on.
Wow.
Well, they always say, physician, heal thyself. My mama used to say that all the time. So it's good to know that in the time when you needed it most, that you were able to explore this in your personal life as well and not just be a teacher, but be a student. But just to bring it back to a high point, just what are some of the wins that you've been seeing recently? with reference to diet culture. I mean, I'm looking at the news. You see the Ozempic, that new drug, and the buccal fat removal on your face. Do we have any wins, Jessica? is there a light at the end of this very chubby tunnel?
That's funny. There's my friend Whitney and Angelus just put together the first eating disorder conference with only Black and Brown speakers last year, and that'll be an annual thing. And now, super impressive, because the narratives, you know, eating disorder conferences have just been weird, we'll say, and very white. So having this conference is amazing. A personal win is the 20-year-olds who are reading the book coming back with their analysis and questions that are smarter than me. And I'm like, excuse me, this is not how this works. I am supposed to have a quick answer for every question that you ask me. And now I don't? No. And so having folks like really want to engage in this material has been great. And I was like, there is hope. It is 25-year-olds and I'm happy about that.
I love that.
Well, we are so glad that you are here to guide the 20-year-olds into the
and the 40-something-year-olds,
honey, because we out here.
Self-acceptance.
We are out here. Yes, we love it. Thank you so much, Jessica. This is such an interesting conversation because it's something that we all deal with, but it's also something like secret that we don't talk about a lot. And, you know, no one wants to say they're on a diet. Nobody wants to say how they feel about their personal body journey. So it's really important that we have these conversations. So I really appreciate you.
It was great. Thank you.
And as part of all of our interviews, we have a set of questions that we ask all of our guests. And so are you ready, Jessica, for the Honey Cues?
Okay, I'm
the
on
honey
it.
Honey Cues need theme songs. I feel like
I'm about to sing it.
Honey Cues, Honey Cues. All right.
I'll keep going. But
are you ready for the Honey Cues?
All righty.
In one sentence, Jessica, who are you?
My ancestors' wildest dreams?
Yes. Yes.
Love that answer.
Okay.
Who are you becoming?
I'm working on becoming independently wealthy. Does that work?
Well, sign me up. Where do we take that class?
Yeah. The lottery is really the class, but I'm working on it.
Okay. Next question. What's your secret desire?
I think this, is it a secret that I want to just live a boring life, an average life where I, you know, can just be?
Yes. But that's a fantastic desire.
It's a fantastic goal. And it is a secret because everyone wants us to be extraordinary all the freaking
time. That's fair. Black excellence.
And it's exhausting. Yeah. So yes, I love this idea. What's your guilty pleasure?
Honestly, I hate how much I enjoy the Peloton bike and the Peloton rower. I feel so basic and I feel so white about it. I hate it, but it's really, I hate it. It feels, you know, so fitness culture and like all these things, but shout out to the one Black UK instructor who makes me laugh on the bike every time. So that's a good guilt.
Our producer Diane loves the Peloton as well. So we're here with you, girl. We are here with you. What do you love most about being a honey?
Laughing loudly and being around women who laugh loudly. Yeah, 100%. Yes.
If you've ever heard me and Ivy get to laughing, honey, that's why Di has to turn our mics down because we.
You got to laugh with abandon
loudly.
At this point. Just let it all go.
Yeah. Loudly.
And do you want to name a honey that deserves her flowers right now?
I will name the person on the cover of my book. So if you've seen the cover, it is my friend who accidentally, but also intentionally, ended up on the cover of my book. And she has got the biggest, loudest laugh and has really been the person who, you know, was interviewed in the book, was a professional editor for the book, is on the cover of the book. And her you know, anti-hunger work and fat liberation work has, you know, really transformed me and a lot of other people. So Shayna, thank you for being on the cover. Shayna McDavis Conway is on the cover. She's rad.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you so much, Jessica. This has been a very fascinating conversation, and one that's probably going to have us talking and thinking about processing. It much later after this. Absolutely processing, particularly as I'm doing pull-ups at my next training session.
Thinking about
where can honeys find you, you know, and your book? Where can they purchase it? And we'll make sure, of course, we put it in the show notes.
Book is available at all major retailers, and you can order it from any of your independent places. I am on Instagram at firstnamejessicawilson.msandmichael, ssandsam, rsandrobert, dsanddog. And I'm moving on over also to try my hand at book talk. So I'm at Jessica Wilson TikTok. On TikTok. Here I am. I'm just going to make that transition. So Instagram and TikTok would be where to find me.
Fantastic. So we are so excited for you, Jessica. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing as well. I know that it's not easy work, so we appreciate you. We're so grateful and can't wait to see all the being that you will continue to do, for sure.
Thanks so much. This was super fun.
Thank Ciao, you so much. Please.
So, Ivy.
I'm going to go eat a ham hock.
You've been waiting to eat a ham hock. So what have you taken away from this amazing conversation that we had with Jessica?
Well, you know, I feel like, first of all, my mind was so blown about this idea and concept that like dietitians are still being taught this sort of very, you know, politically sort of minded way of thinking about foods from ethnic groups. It's so mind blowing to me that we are still in a place where we are talking to people in ways that sort of vilify ethnic foods, ethnic traditions. It's just, I mean, everything.
Just leave
has
us
a place
alone. Leave us alone.
Why we can't be ask you to eat nothing?
The fuck alone.
Did we tell you how to fry chicken? No, we didn't tell you how to fry chicken. We was eating fried chicken ourselves.
We clearly didn't tell them. We clearly didn't tell them, okay?
We're eating yams every day, you know? And, you know, the paleos love the sweet potato culture. So, but that is so mind-blowing to me. And the idea also that we should be choosing our own adventures here, right?
Yeah.
The idea is that we should be taking, like, really taking in our own idea of what healthy is and being able to craft that for ourselves and being able to make, you know, whatever your intuitive eating, whatever the thing is that you want to really drive, making that work for you. And it's very individual, and it should also be centered around some of the environmental, psychological, trauma focused, all those things that are happening in your life. I love that idea of making it very holistic as opposed to just about the meal that you're eating today and whether or not it's small enough, thin enough, low fat enough, high fat enough, whatever. I love that idea about making it feel about your whole life and not just about the food.
Yes, yes, yes.
What about you, Felicia?
Yeah, I mean, for me, definitely the acceptance no matter what. And if we're really centering joy, because like, you know how I feel about joy.
I do.
Full-time job is to protect my Black joy. And I feel like that's all we got. You know what I mean? Like, and that's where I'm going to put my time. I'm going to put my time in pursuing community and pursuing what makes me feel good and what makes me feel like I can go out into the world. Do you know what I mean? In a healthy way. So that was very big for me to just continue to think about all the ways I can be loving up on Felicia, no matter what stage of life she's in. Is very, very exciting.
I think that's beautiful.
Because I started to kind of do a little mirror work, honey. I just be looking at myself naked and I am turned on, honey. I'm like, this grown woman body. This is grown woman. Okay. This is grown woman. This, she's seen some things. And, no, and a lot of people ain't ready for that. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I pray for them though. That they get
that's
ready.
Right, girl. Prayers up. They ain't ready for that jelly, girl.
They not.
Until we see each other again,
honeys. Thank y'all for so much for all the support and love and encouragement. We see you, we hear you, and Child, please.
Y'all go ahead and be free. Child, please. If you want, you gotta go get it.
Child, please is brought to you by Honey Child. Episodes drop every other Tuesday. You can find us anywhere you listen to podcasts. Apple, Spotify, Google, Amazon, iHeart, Stitcher. And if you like what you hear, write a review, tell a friend. And to keep the conversation going, sign up for A Taste of Honey, our newsletter. You can find that at www.honey-child.com. That's honey-child.com. And follow us on Instagram at @itshoneychild.
Hey, honeys. Honey Child is an independent boutique media and entertainment company run by Black women. We speak with love to an underserved audience, Black women 40 and over, or honeys as we call them. And we're not just bringing our own seats. We're building our own damn table, too. And we'd love for you to be a part of it. Become a Honey Insider. Support what you want to see in the world and receive exclusive access to what we're building. To learn more, head to our website at honey-child.com, honey-child.com.